Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:34 p.m. on Friday, April 22nd, 2016. Present today, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler. I'm Co-Chair Thompson. We have Co-Chair Newman, Representative Munoz, Representative Edgman, Representative Guttenberg, and a couple more will be joining us shortly. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. No electronic devices, please, in Finance Committee. Today we'll be reviewing the fiscal notes for Senate Bill 91. Committee members, your packets of fiscal notes have been, they're in the order in the sequence in which they will be heard. Please refer to the circle number on the top of the front page of each fiscal note so we can make sure we're all on the same page. First, we'll review the first three fiscal notes from the Department of Administration. Here to speak to them, to these fiscal notes, are Fiscal Note 1, Department of Administration, Legal and Advocacy Services, Office of Public Advocacy, OMB number 43, Mr. Rick Allen, the Director of Office of Public Advocacy. Fiscal Note 2, Department of Administration, Legal and Advocacy Services, Public Defender Agency, OMB 1631, Mr. Quinlan Steiner, the Public Defender. And then we have Fiscal Note 3, Department of Administration, Motor Vehicle, OMB 2348, Ms. Amy Erickson, the Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Can you please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and then begin with Fiscal Note 1. Dun, dun, dun. Were the others online? Oh, I didn't know they were here. Rick Allen is online, and Amy Erickson, I believe, is online also. So the first one up is Mr. Rick Allen on fiscal note number one.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. This is, for the record, this is Rick Allen. I'm the director of the Office of Public Advocacy. We have submitted a zero fiscal note with a brief explanation to the note. If there's if you have any questions or anything, I'd be happy to answer them, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the committee members are reading the note attached to the fiscal note right now. Representative Gary, you had a question.
Is there any way we can get some guardian ad litem in here?
No.
Next year?
Maybe. Representative Gaddis. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Mr. Allen?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So could you tell me how much of the population that comes back are second and third offenders that maybe you, and I know this is just a guess, how many you won't see coming back if these programs work?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, at this stage, that would really be speculative on my part. Certainly, we're all very, very hopeful that, you know, these programs have the impact that we expect and that we do see a reduction in recidivism. But in terms of trying to put a percentage or a number on that, I'd be uncomfortable with doing that because it really would be speculation.
Okay, and a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And I appreciate that. Do you have any idea how many are repeat offenders that you currently have, those who you've gone through the system and then come back and need help again?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, we do. A general rule, we're looking at about two-thirds of offenders traditionally will reoffend in some fashion. So, it's a pretty high number at this stage.
And one more follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
And is there any way, and I don't know, and this goes to anybody who might be coming up, to know how many of those repeat offenders end up needing a public defender or public, or this, versus private attorneys?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the court system, I believe, would have some exact data for you, but I can tell you that the majority of criminal defendants receive public counsel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further questions on fiscal note number one? Seeing none, we'll move on to fiscal note number two, Department of Administration, Legal and Advocacy Services, Public Defender Agency, OMB 1631. Mr. Quinlan Steiner, Public Defenders.
Thank you. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the Public Defender for the State of Alaska. We also put in a zero fiscal note. Although we do anticipate benefits from this, they are entirely speculative at this point until we know what programs are going to be funded and we start to measure their effectiveness on the reduction in recidivism. But since recidivism has been consistent up to this point, I was unable to make any projection about what kind of reduction in workload. Also important to remember that over the decades, the caseload has far exceeded the budget growth as a percentage for many decades in a row, and we've never really quite caught up. So again, it was difficult for me to make any estimation about what fiscal benefit might occur. But
okay, Representative Wilson.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. So will you, maybe this would be a better way to ask it, will you be keeping some type of statistics to see whether or not the cases you currently have, because I understand, you've had to we've cut your budget and you still have more cases than you have. Is there a way for you to keep track to kind of give us a number coming back to whether or not the growth keeps outweighing what you have versus you are now starting to see some type of decrease?
Through the chair, yes, we keep track of our appointments, so I can tell from year to year what my appointments are. The actual workload per case is a little bit harder to estimate objectively. There's a bit of a subjective component to that because we don't have the tools to measure the objective workload. But yes, the actual number of appointments I measure from year to year, and I know can tell if they're going up or down.
And a follow-up,
Mr. Chairman. Jenny Wilson.
And in that count, do you keep separate those who are coming back again versus those who are new offenders?
Through the chair, I do not at this point. I think that would require a hand count of the cases. That you'd have to audit the workload. It's not something we track, whether or not somebody has a prior conviction as part of our case management system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say a thank you and then also ask a question. Rick on the phone, Quinlan, the folks of the court system, folks of the district attorney's office, most of us know, if not all of us, that when you get extra cases and you don't get extra staff and maybe you lose staff, your staff are working really long hours, like incredibly long hours, weekends, nights, and hopefully we can reverse this trend at some point, but I just wanted to ask you to thank that.
Is there a question in there anywhere?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you to thank your staff for that. The question is, even though caseloads may go down, the more therapeutic court cases you do, those are high-intensive cases, right? So part of this is we bring the caseloads down, but we're anticipating more therapeutic court work, and that adds more work, I take it?
Through the chair, that's correct. Those cases tend to be a little bit more work than one that just resolves as a plea agreement because the case will live on and you'll be advising the client and participating throughout. And that's kind of what I was referencing, the difference between caseload and workload. One's very easy to measure objectively, the other one is not.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mrs. Steiner. In the spirit of recognizing that you would be criticized for almost any number you put in here. Zero might be the safest bet because you don't know. But all through this process we've heard, we'll get to that when we get to the fiscal notes. So the commissioner spent some time talking about the success of these various programs in other states. And anticipating changes. You know, some of your workload might get bigger, some of it might get smaller. Did you look at what's going to happen or the change of caseloads and type of work that you have to do compared with what's happening in other states where other places have had these programs in place?
Through the chair, not specifically. What I've looked at with regard to the workload per case, there's a current standard from the American Bar Association about how many cases a public defender can handle in a year, and that's the standard that we use now. And presently, we have more cases than that standard allows. There are other states that have done specific workload studies that end up having much lower maximum caseloads than the ABA standard, and that requires a level of work to put into place that we don't have the ability to do right now. There's a huge study that goes along with it, keeping track of time and estimates of time to come to a number that's defensible. So they're very jurisdiction specific. So I've looked at other states, but not with respect to the changes in workload as a result of these initiatives, but I have looked at other states as they look at workload versus caseload and how to measure it appropriately. It's something I would like to do in the future to get a better, more objective measure of workload.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Senator Guttenberg.
You know, we're all looking forward to the success of this, and measuring those things, part of that is going to be requiring your group, your department, to be able to monitor those things and act like a law firm, and every 6 minutes you hit the timekeeper, whatever it is. Do you have the capabilities or the computer functions in your office to be able to do that now?
Through the chair, we would have the capability to keep track of time.
Okay.
Technically, it's not that hard. You can just write it down. The ability to process it, kind of collate it, make sense of it, and then analyze whether or not that's telling us what we need to know, that would require something that we don't have funding for. The real adjustment, it's called a qualitative adjustment. So if I keep track of my time, I might just explain to you what I'm doing, but it won't explain to you what I'm not doing. And trying to figure out what we're not doing that we're supposed to be doing, that's the hard part. That would require additional funding to have that analyzed and collected.
Thank you. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. A lot of what we're trying to do is tell us what you're not going to need to do, and that's tough. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quinlan, thank you. Not knowing the activities, what the Public Defenders Agency does, I have a little difficulty. Quinlan Steiner, pardon me, so we get a lot of names. I just don't see if we're calling for more court activities and management of those activities, how it's going to have a zero impact on the Public Defender Agency. I'm not sure if this zero represents a net zero, more activities, one layer less than the other, or if it shouldn't be indeterminate, because I think I heard you saying you don't quite know what the effect's going to be. But a zero is pretty definitive, and I just have to probe that a little bit.
Through the chair, my estimation is that there won't be overall additional work as a result of this bill. My estimation is that what additional work might occur in therapeutic courts might be offset by the jail trips we don't have to take. We spend time just going to jail every day, and that's an enormously time-consuming event. With fewer people in jail, our lawyers will have more time to work on their cases in their offices, and there's just no way for me to estimate what the exact impact of that's going to be. I know that because caseloads have exceeded budget growth over the decades, that even if I get a benefit in the short run, there won't be an immediate decrement that I could take. I would still be, right around the max caseload. And that's the part that needs to get sorted out in the future, because if this works properly, it is theoretically possible that the caseload goes down enough that we would potentially be able to take a decrement sort of ethically. But we've already taken decrements over the last 2 years in terms of staffing that's pushing our max caseload over the limit.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
So recognizing that it is a bit of an imprecise science, would you be any more comfortable? I mean, obviously you submitted it as is, but it seems to me it might be a little bit more reflective of what you described if it were indeterminate as opposed to zero, but it's your fiscal note.
Through the chair, I've always used indeterminate fiscal notes when I knew there was going to be a fiscal impact increasing my costs, but I couldn't determine them. I don't think there's going to be additional work as a result of this bill, and so I put in a zero because I had no anticipation of increase.
Just had to probe it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Follow-up question, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the point I tried to make before, and I'll make it really briefly. They're just used to, it'll be a zero fiscal note because they're used to just working longer hours. So it's going to be the same number of people, but they work longer hours if they have to. So that's why it's zero, in my view, which is unfortunate, but that's the reality right now.
Thank you.
It's true.
All right. Okay, we will, Mr. Steiner, thank you. We're going to move on to fiscal note number three, the Department of Administration, Motor Vehicles, Motor Vehicle OMB 2348. Ms. Amy Erickson, the Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles, is online. Ms. Erickson, can you place yourself on record, please?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Mr. Chairman, the current fiscal note you have has been restored by the committee to be a zero fiscal note. However, DMV submitted one that did have a fiscal impact because of the provisions of the off-highway licensing amendment. And we believe that that would require a new position for DMV and also loss of about $137,000 a year in vehicle registration fees.
Okay. Questions on fiscal note number three? Representative Kawasaki.
So currently, the current way the bill stands is that bill has, or the bill has been amended to do the off-highway road. So is this zero fiscal note really a correct fiscal note, considering the bill before us still has
it? With anticipation that we will have a change in the bill to where that original fiscal note will be zero. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's probably fair for those that are watching to know that we are working on this fiscal note, but as the representative from Fairbanks indicated, brought up that we may have something else before us, so that some of the things that have a zero fiscal note and that we anticipate will continue having a zero fiscal note, so those listening know that we're still working on this project, so that's why it would have a zero fiscal note as we move forward.
As any changes are made, we will be getting new fiscal notes for those changes from the administration, so we will bring those back up at that time. All right, Ms. Erickson, I don't see any more questions. Thank you, Mr. Steiner, Ms. Erickson, and Mr. Allen. Okay, we're going to move on to Department of Corrections fiscal notes. These are fiscal notes 4 through 10, and we have Ms. April Wilkerson. Please come to the table. Division Director for Administrative Services will walk us through corrections, fiscal notes. And Commissioner Dean Williams is also online. Okay, we'll start with fiscal note number 4, Department of Corrections, Administration and Support, Information Technology, MISOMB number 698. Place yourself on the record, Ms. Erickson, or Wilkerson.
My name is April Wilkerson. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. Fiscal note 4. Is the funding that would be needed to adjust the department's offender time accounting system, our Alaska Corrections Offender Management System, the ACOMS database, to accurately reflect the good time and the time accounting changes that are reflective in the bill. It's anticipated that we would need about $1.5 million to address those changes, as well as any changes associated with the victim notification system that the department has to notify the victims of the offenders for release.
Okay, we have questions. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you already keep track of good time. You already keep track of making sure the victims are notified for when it's time for them to be able to come. So I'm trying to figure out what exactly needs to be changed, and, man, we need a better system if every time we want to make a change it's $1 million.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, our offender management time accounting system, the changes in the bill would require a contractor to come in and write that program to go into the ACOM system to meet the additional changes. The time accounting system that the state has currently for offender time management is pretty complicated. And to increase and adjust the time that is being calculated by the database would require an additional contractor to come in and make those changes. And given the short amount of time to get it deployed, what we're finding right now, our programmers can maintain the system, but to make the additional changes that are needed, as we make one change, it seems that another area of the system ends up corrupted.
Senator Wilson.
I guess what I don't understand is that we give good time now, and then we're going to give good time to others if they earn it. We're doing pre-trial now, pre-sentence. This offers a few more people being able to utilize it. So we have the same group, I mean, inmates. They already qualify for a lot of these things. We're opening that up a little bit, but I don't see how that's actually changing the system within itself.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we did take a look at that, and we just don't currently have the ability to rewrite the formula for the time accounting that's being applied currently, and we would need the additional resources to rewrite that code.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilson.
I guess what I'm trying to get to is that there's good time allowed now. This allows, you know, a few more people to be able to do that, but that all has to be entered now. So is the system not quite up to date? Does this ask that you're needing not just about this bill, but also upgrades that you may need because of how long it may be taking currently for the population?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, no, it's not fixing the database. It's taking the database from where we're at and moving it forward. I need a lifeline to help explain that.
Yeah, I need a lifeline too.
Yeah.
Do we have anybody else here with you that is a lifeline?
I don't believe there's anybody online right now, but I would be glad to come back and talk to the committee about the additional resources.
Good, please. Mm-hmm. Give that information to my staff, and we'll get it out to everybody.
Okay.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And really what I'm trying to understand is that we're not changing the population. Everybody still, you know, who goes to jail, goes to jail. We already have mechanisms for everything that we're doing here now. We are opening up to who's eligible for it, which that's the part that I'd like to understand, what the difference is between just making more people being allowed to do it and how that would be different than how you keep time now. Thank you, and I'll just look forward to the answer.
Thank you. Further questions from committee on fiscal note number 4? Seeing none, we'll move on to fiscal note number 5, Department of Corrections Population Management. Institution Director's Office, OMB 1381. Ms. Wilkerson?
Fiscal note number 5 is the anticipated reduction in the population that is expected from the passage of this legislation through the sentencing changes, the good time credits. We anticipate in the first year to have a reduction in the population of 299 offenders. That equates to $4.5 million. And then in FY18, a reduction of 1,363 offenders for a net reduction, for an overall reduction of 20.6 million, and continued reduction in 2019 of 205 offenders with an additional 3.1 million reduction. In 2020, we do anticipate the population to increase at that time, going back up by about 112, and a slight increase of 1.7 million. And then in 2021, an additional increase of 139 inmates. And in 2022, 172. However, the overall net impact is still a reduction to the department's budget, a cumulative of $21.86 million.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wilkerson, it looks like the trend is not, you know, the number of population is increase, looks by an increasing amount. First off, what's the reason for the increase? Is there something happening 4 years out we should know about? And is that trend likely to continue increasing such that there will be no net savings in another 5 years or so?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, yes, that is correct. So what we see in the initial first years are the impacts of the legislation. However, once that is assumed and is in place, we will see the net result of the increases in the population that we're experiencing, such as some of the murder charges are still going to go on and the other areas in other criminal activity that drives the population back up. And that trend does continue to go back up in the out years, just at a much slower and more leveled off rate.
No, I just needed to hear that. I was glad to hear at a slower rate because, as I say, it looks like from 112 to 139 to 172, that's an accelerating rate. And I don't know if that accelerated rate will carry through to how many years.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I don't have that continued population trend out, but we do have that, and I can provide that as well.
Hopefully this crime bill will change some behavior in people so that there won't be as many violent crimes in the future. So hopefully that will continue to decline. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wilkerson. Can you tell me if these numbers and these population reduction projected numbers include the folks that will reoffend? Right now, two-thirds of the folks who will reoffend within the first 2 years, I think it is that inclusive in the projections?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, no, the recidivism is not calculated into those numbers. Those are the anticipated reductions from the changes in the sentencing and laws.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki.
I mean, sort of, I guess my thought of this, the point of this bill was to, I mean, really get a restorative justice sort of model through the Criminal Justice Commission work. I mean, if we're still anticipating that two-thirds of the folks are going to come back, I guess shouldn't that be built into the fiscal note as well?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, I believe that you'll see that addressed in the other fiscal notes with the changes in the probation and the credits there, the additional community treatments and the other areas that are within the bill as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to recognize also, I forgot to put on the record, but the bill sponsor, Senator Coghill, is in the audience also. Representative Gaddis has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I was going down the same road that my friend from Fairbanks was going down as well. When I see this as a bill that's supposed to change not only how we do business, if you will, but how our criminals do business, and where we're looking at how to treat them. So when we look at our treatment, so on, I think I'm going to let the rest of the fiscal notes play out before I ask this final question, and maybe it'll solve itself as we move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is where this would fall, because it's population management. But the question I have is, what I don't see is a reduction in terms of personnel. We show a lot of savings with reduction in the population management. Do we foresee reduction in personnel, or do we foresee that some of those positions will move to other areas because there's other fiscal notes we haven't gotten to yet that will need additional people? What's the dynamic in terms of personnel?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, we do anticipate as the population declines and going into 18 and 19 that we will be able to identify a potential closure of a facility and reallocating those resources. When we get to the pretrial fiscal note, you'll see that out years are indeterminate because we do anticipate being able to reallocate those resources towards pretrial and towards other areas within the remaining facilities that are probably short-staffed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Representative Pruitt.
And another question, thank you, that kind of helps me with that. Another question is related to the page two and talking about the population numbers. Obviously, 2018 is really when the big savings arises. Do we just see that as being, because this, I think the effective date on this is this year, so it shouldn't necessarily, I guess it applies to people, though, that have already been in for a period of time, though, right? It's so if you have been at whatever it may be and you've now hit it, we're changing the, for some of these people, we are going to change what they initially thought when they were sentenced was their time to get out or time to get on parole. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative, yes, that is correct. Not only will it change release dates, it will change furlough eligibility dates, and as well as early release from parole, early release from probation.
Okay, and that's Mr. Chair, and just follow. So that's why we would expect 18 would have that just massive number, which that's, I mean, it's a pretty large number. If they're almost 1,400, and it's because of that. Okay,
that's correct. Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if the first two numbers work approximately 300 with the 1,363, comes out to about 1,600, is that enough to close any one of the prisons we currently have?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we would really, yes, but we really need to take a look at the population, where that the remaining population is housed, what those needs are. It could potentially be a part of a facility, or it could be reflective of a whole facility.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More power to you. I think the biggest goal is to not build another prison.
That's a more goal, positive.
I take it the fiscal note for 2017, $4.52 million in savings. I don't really mean to try and make a point by this, but this fiscal note was written at a time. Was this fiscal note written very recently, or was it written earlier in session when we thought we would end up in time, end session in time?
Through the chair to Representative Garrett, it was updated on the 15th of this month.
All right, sure. I suppose that's fine.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Sadler?
Ms. Wilkerson, through the chair, the last line of the second page of the fiscal note says annual savings are calculated at a marginal cost rate of $41.49 per day per person. My understanding was I've seen a number of about $150. Is this half of the rate? Help me understand what that is, and are we saving as much as we thought we would?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, we did select a marginal rate. The daily cost of care rate for this calendar year is $141.17 per day per inmate. Those are all-in costs. What we did is we took our cost of care document and we removed those known costs that, such as utilities and staffing, and we put in the flexible costs that are adjustable to arrive at a marginal cost. So it is potential that in the future we could see a higher reduction in the savings to the budget if a facility was actually to be closed.
Thank you. That helps.
All right. Any further questions on fiscal note number 5? Seeing none, we'll move to fiscal note number 6. The Department of Corrections, Population Management, Statewide, Probation and Parole, OMB 2826. Ms. Wilkerson?
Fiscal note number 6 for the statewide probation and parole, this legislation does grant credit and provides for an incentive program for allowing probationers good time. So for 30 days of compliance, they could receive 30 days off of their probation sentence. We do anticipate a reduction in the probation caseloads. However, we also anticipate additional individuals coming onto the caseloads from those that are earning good time out of the facilities. So we did submit a zero fiscal note that we do believe at this time it would be a wash.
Be offsetting each other. Questions from committee on fiscal note number 6. Representative co-chair Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, April. You come with a lot of high praises from the department internally. Anyhow, I just wanted to know, is there anything in this fiscal note that would reflect changes in the sentencing and parole for good time for sexual predators? Sexual assault crimes.
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that is reflective in here as well. We have the sex offender probation officers that have their current caseload, so that is calculated in here for that adjustment as well.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that was fiscal note number 6. We're going to move to fiscal note number 7, Department of Corrections, Population Management, Community Residential Centers, OMB 2244. Ms. Wilkerson.
Fiscal note number 7 is asking for $300,000 in 2017 and an additional $500,000 in 2018. And then an additional $200,000 in fiscal year 19. That funding would be utilized to support the Community Residential Center programming, and it is reflective of the changes in Section 158 that requires the department to have the contract providers provide rehabilitation programming that also sets standards for the treatment and the risk assessments of those that are housed in those facilities.
Our number 7 shows in years 2019, 20, 21, and 22, $1 million each year.
To the chair, I received a revised fiscal note from the House Finance Committee, and I'm reading those numbers.
Well, the one we have, it's dated 4/21 of 2016, is showing a million, 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 million. So, hold on. There you are. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure we were on the same page.
Oh, to the chair, I apologize. I was reading the increments per fiscal year for a net total of $1 million starting in FY19 to carry on.
All right. Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's my understanding that we have open beds in a lot of these facilities, and we are actually paying for them because they don't have any place else to give them to. So why can't some of those open beds offset some of the costs that are in here, since we're paying them extra money and there's not extra inmates in those beds?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we are anticipating renegotiating all the contracts to utilize that funding as well to support the increased programming.
Follow up.
Andy Wilson.
So we have a center with 100 beds, and let's say we only have 60 people in those 100 beds, but we're paying for all 100. I guess what I'm saying is, since we're getting paid for 40 more beds than what they have cost, right, because there's nobody in those, is there a way that these new the new program can kind of be already as part of that 100 versus increasing it by this much?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we do anticipate filling those beds with the releasing population. It's part of, we don't anticipate increasing the bed count now, but we do anticipate utilizing those unfilled beds with the changes in this legislation.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so I could buy that one. Okay, so now you're going to save money, though, in the facility that you're at $150 or more into a much lower cost one. So, again, wouldn't that money filter down from the prison down to the CRCs? I guess I don't see where there's an increase of money, because we're supposed to be saving money from this area over to here. Why wouldn't that money just flow over that's already in corrections?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we had looked at whether we should decrement down. The department made the decision to try and maintain the funding because we are working even right now to get those beds filled. We have recently changed one of the practices in the Anchorage area, and we've started placing the unsentenced population back in the CRC. The majority of the rest of the CRCs are primarily filled at 99% of the capacity. We do anticipate not only using the regular beds, but also the portions of the per diem beds, which that would then require the need for the additional funding to meet the substance abuse programming that we need to get implemented.
Perhaps any Wilson, you see you I have guess, another question.
I guess it's not really a question. It's a concern because there is no backup on my number 7, used to be number, well, it's number 7. I don't know what it used to be. And so it doesn't show, you know, whether or not these CRCs are going to need to hire more people, you know, than what they currently have. So it's not just, so that's where the cost is coming from. There's no reflection, like on the previous note, of the savings that we're going to have by not having as many. It's just there's no backup to show the 300,000. I understand what is being said, but without having the other part of the fiscal note of how many are going to be changed over, whether or not these CRCs are going to have to hire more people to be able to do that, and that's, I guess that's where I'm trying to make that connection.
Ms. Wilkerson also just called in and is online, is Commissioner Dean Williams. If you need a lifeline, you can call on him.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead.
Maybe you have backup and I just don't.
Yeah. Through the chair to Representative Wilson, I did have a second page to the fiscal note. The calculation came about based on our programming cost internally. We don't anticipate allowing a contractor to charge more than what we could do it in-house for under our current contracts. So that's where we got to the funding needed that we to expand those into the community CRCs.
Maybe we could just get page 2. That might help, Mr. Chairman.
If we can get that to my committee, we'll make sure we get it passed out to the committee members. Representative Kawasaki, followed by Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, having page 2 would be a benefit, just because this is a revised fiscal note, and I just don't I just don't know what it used to look like. And
do you have page 2 there?
I do.
Mr. Anderson? If you could get page 2 from her and make copies, we don't have those in our packets. Representative Kawasaki, further questions?
Yeah, the description on page 1, the sole page of the fiscal note, just says that it's revised and that it's funding for community residential centers. Is that the correctional restitution centers that we're talking about within the status of the bill?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, yes, it is.
Okay. And then
Representative Kawasaki.
Well, I guess, actually, I'll just wait until I see the dialogue on page 2. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Sadler?
Yes.
Followed by Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Wilkerson. Yeah, that's going to be helpful. Just from what I know of the cost of treatment, if indeed the $1 million is supposed to cover the cost for the CRCs, comprehensive treatment for substance abuse and cognitive behavioral disorders and other criminal risk factors, including aftercare, is a big lift. That's a tremendous mission, and I would like to know how confident you are in that this can all be provided for, I think there's 800 beds for just $1 million. That's a model of economy I'd love to apply elsewhere in behavioral health services, if indeed that's accurate.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, we are currently providing those cognitive programs within the institutions at the rate that was used to calculate this out. We felt that we could either internally through our existing institutional contracts expand those out to meet the community, or through the CRCs having them provide that same level.
And thank you for that. I'm glad to hear that. I'd like to know what the rate is, but also I see that the funds are all in services, which is not personal services, which would be state employees. So services, does that mean it's going to be contracted out to privately run CRCs or?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, yes. It would be either directly through the programs that are offered through the CRCs or through our contract providers that are currently providing institutional support.
And we tried to get Sadler. We asked the commissioner a couple or somebody a few days ago about the number of capacity. We did get about 800 and some beds, but how many individual specific community correctional restitution centers does the state operate or contract with?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, we have 8 contract facilities. We have 6 contracts. We have locations in Bethel, Juneau, Fairbanks, Nome, and then we have 3 centers that are in Anchorage area.
Bethel, Fairbanks, Nome,
Juneau.
Juneau.
And 3 in Anchorage.
Yes. So there's seven.
Mr. Chairman?
What's the rate? If I
can I make just one clarification, because I kind of started this problem?
Representative Wilson.
This is not undesignated general funds. This is actually recidivism reduction money.
Right.
So they are actually using money that's in the system right now to go over here, which is kind of what my question was. And so I just want to clarify that I thought this was new money, and it's not new money. This is actual money because they're moving it out. So this is the savings they're not going to have in the hard beds. They're going to move over into the CRCs to still be able to get the treatment that there is. So my apologies. I was trying to read them faster than what I should have. So it is not new money, and that's what I thought it was. So I just want to make sure since I started, I clarified.
Thank you.
And through the chair, just a last follow-up, make sure the day rate you said you calculated?
Yeah. Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the daily rate for housing or the daily rate for the programming?
The daily rate for the services identified in the fiscal note.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, that was $3. It's approximately $3.35 per person per day.
Okay, we have another lifeline coming up.
Wow.
If you'd place yourself on the record and help us out.
Good afternoon. My name is Kelly Cunningham. I'm with Legislative Finance. I just wanted to, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I just wanted to clarify on the funding for the CRC fiscal note. It's using new funds. I don't believe we have addressed the new tax, the marijuana, projected receipts from the marijuana tax that are in the bill. A new fund is created as a sub-fund of the general fund, and that is what is funding that.
Appreciate it. Okay, moving around on questions, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. A question on that, and then a question to the commissioner if he's online. The question on this fiscal note and using the recidivism reduction fund, that's using marijuana tax money. That's not expected to come in for a couple of years, is my impression. So there's a request for 17 and 18. We don't know how much those funds are, but I don't know how mechanically that'll work. Maybe just leave that on the table. But my question for the commissioner, I think it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before, when we were talking about the residential, the community residential centers. Am I talking to somebody online? you said earlier,
Commissioner Williams, are you there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I am here, and I apologize I'm not with you today. I had to come back to Anchorage today, but I apologize, but I am online.
You're a lucky man. You got to go home. Place yourself on the record, and then Representative Guttenberg has a question.
Yeah, Dean Williams, Commissioner for Corrections in Anchorage.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I wanted to make sure I was not involved with the source of these funds. The other day, you made reference to your concerns about substance abuse control in the residential community centers and how you were having a problem with sending somebody that needed a treatment into one of these programs when you were putting in an environment when it was inappropriate for them to be there. How does this affect that your reasoning and your concern?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So I was talking rather broadly about the issue. There are some halfway houses that we know are doing quite well. There are certain locations where we know we have more specific problems. You know, none of this improving the CRCs is going to be a process, and there's nothing that's going to be magical about doing that overnight or anything. I don't see a conflict here in terms of starting to build up what's happening inside the halfway houses while we continue to improve them. Our contractors, Geo Group, for example, and there's another one too, they want these places to be very clean and good operating as well. We just, quite frankly, think it's been a bit of source of neglect in terms of paying attention and making sure and improving the quality. So I guess I don't see a conflict in that. I see them, as we continue to rely more upon the halfway houses and work on the efforts of improving them, I think that's quite congruent and consistent with the effort and this bill.
Follow up, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want treatment to go where it's most effective, to where that point is.
Right.
I know we have substance abuse inside of prisons, and that always amazes me. But I want to make sure that when we put a drug treatment program or an alcohol program into a halfway house, that the people we're trying to put in the program are in an appropriate place, that is an appropriate environment, and that's my concern.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I had failed to recognize Representative Reinbold has been with us in the audience also. Welcome. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And sorry, I just had to step out for a second, so I'm sorry if I missed it. For the Correctional Restitution Centers, this is an increment. Is it because we anticipate the cost of a newly negotiated contract, inclusive of other treatments, will cost more?
Ms. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki. This funding would add in the additional element of providing the programming, not change the bed rate that we're currently paying. In addition, there's additional language that will also require the standards to ensure that measures are taken to not mix the high and low custody, and so the risk assessments of the offenders and the mixing of the population would also be addressed.
Representative Kawasaki.
So am I to understand that this would be additional funding for additional support staff or something to come into the facilities to offer this type of a treatment, or would it be within their own facilities? Was it something they already do, or is it something that they might be able to add on, and the money's for an increase in the contract cost?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, a combination of both. So if the contractor can provide that level of programming that's approved by the department, then we would contract and it would go to them. Otherwise, they would be, or we would be, providing contract services to go into the CRCs to provide that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sadler has another question.
Thank you. It's more of a comment. Just the language of, again, I'll say it again, I'll stop, the comprehensive treatment for substance abuse, cognitive behavioral disorders, and other criminal factors, to do that for $3.35 a day per person, I just don't see how that's possible. And if so, we've got a large number of people that would like to and need to receive comprehensive treatment for substance abuse, that if we can do over $3.25 a day or $3.35 a day, I'd like to know more about that. I guess I'm just saying I have a hard time believing that.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler. So in our cost of care, it's calculated out to get an average, and we use that average based on the number of beds. But we also know that based on the risk assessments, that will be the deciding factor on who actually receives the programming. It could be that not every one of the 819 individuals receive the programming. So it is a fluctuating cost, but it is an average cost based on in total. So it would be a higher rate for the actual individual that is served.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I think this is a pretty easy response, but we just passed an omnibus health care bill, Senate Bill 74, but is there any provisions in that bill that relate to the area that these fiscal notes address in terms of, I guess, behavioral health specifically?
Through the chair to Representative Edgman, I know that Ms. Castro is behind me, and I don't want to get it wrong. My understanding right now is no. The provisions do not apply to incarcerated persons, and that does include those that are housed in the CRCs or under probation, only those that are outside of the facility for more than 24 hours.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, just to say that she is nodding her head behind you. So
I got it right?
All right. Any further questions on fiscal note number 7? Yeah, Ms. Cunningham.
Through the chair, I just wanted to say for the record, I helped prepare this revised fiscal note. I apologize. I tried to put it into one page, and that was a mistake. So
that's all right. Thank you very much for being here also. Next, we'll go to fiscal note number 8. Department of Corrections, Population Management, Parole Board, OMB 695. Ms. Wilkerson?
The fiscal note for the Parole Board is an increase overall. For FY 17, they felt that they needed five positions and $775,000 for the first fiscal year. That does include the one-time startup cost. So going into FY 18, you do see a slight drop of $75,000 down to a contained budget of $700,000.9 and the five positions that continue on. That funding is made up of a couple different areas. There's an anticipation of increased board hearings associated with the violations that come back and are reincarcerated. They currently have 120 days before they go before the board again, up to 120 days. The changes in this legislation require that to be within 15 days. And so there is an expectation to increase the number of days that the board meets. And there's $110,000, part of the $700,000 that will meet the increased days associated with the board members. In addition to that, there's, with the adjustment on the hearings, there is an anticipated need for four additional hearing officers, which are currently adult probation officer threes. And that total with their operating needs is $553,000. And then they would need an additional time accounting officer, which is a criminal justice technician, with those operating costs of $112,000 per year. That gives us a total of the $775,000 in the first year.
Fiscal note number eight, questions. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you again, April. In the previous version of the fiscal note, it talks about the redesign and implementation for the Victim Information Network, and I know Representative Wilson had a question about the other part to the first fiscal note. The other part was the Victim Information Network. $750,000 for the redesign. I'm sorry, I was speaking about a different fiscal note now. It was the fiscal note that you had to deal with Vine, improving Vine and improving the sentencing numbers, but the number is actually in here in the fiscal note, and so that's why I'm asking the question. So can you tell me why the redesign for the Vine system will cost three-quarters of $1 million?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, that was an error, and that amount and that end of that statement should not have been there. We revised the fiscal note and submitted it today.
Okay. And then, sure.
Representative Kawasaki?
In the fiscal note, it talks about the total honoraria for the members of the Board of Parole. It used to be a part-time board. Working looks like 140 days for board members. Now it looks like it's coming up to a 200-day, which is pretty close to a real full-time job. And I'm wondering if there's been any consideration about changing the structure of the Board of Parole, which was just approved from a sunset, to make it easier for people to serve in a part-time capacity.
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, I'm unaware of those conversations, but I can work with the commissioner and the executive director of the parole board and the chair of the board to see if that wouldn't help reduce the costs.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Mr. Williams?
Yeah, if you would like me, Mr. Chairman, I would just through the chair, comment to Representative Kawasaki. So, Director Edwards and I have already had that conversation, and so it's something we're looking at already about how we might be able to streamline and put some people online and not everyone travel, and so we're already looking at that as we explore that. That might, you know, impact some regulation issues, but we're looking at that. I'm looking for savings in that because this parole issue, of course, is going to be increasing quite a bit in this bill, and it's going to demand that we think about getting some savings and doing this a little bit more economically than what we have been. So that discussion is already in play.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
No, I appreciate that answer. Commissioner, I think there's one error in this. When it talks about discretionary parole, the new all inmates over the age of 60. I think the bill currently is 55. I don't know if there's anticipation of moving that number. So the approximate number of inmates should be probably higher than 65 under this fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Further questions on fiscal note number 8? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one comment, too, to what the Commissioner just said. I'm glad you're looking at saving money, but I guess just a caution when the victims come and come before the parole board, I just, you know, if you could just be cognizant that they would probably rather talk to people than to boxes or however you're going to be able to have people call in, because this is not just about the inmates, but this is the victim's chance to come in and be able to say that whether they agree or disagree. But my question is, and the representative from Fairbanks kind of talked about it, it's not just about the age or the geriatric, but do we know just that provision in itself, how much it impacts the fiscal note?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, the individuals that are 55 and older, there was only about 112 that are currently in our system that could potentially meet this. However, there are caveats that would prohibit them from actually being released in the legislation, so not more than 112.
And a follow-up? So I understand that this note would be pretty high because you're going to have, just like we did on the last fiscal note that showed a lot of the decreases, would you not see some of these numbers go down after we finally adjust and the system kind of becomes more of a normal? Or because of how much quicker we're trying to get people through, we're always going to be looking at a higher number, and that's why we kind of see a steady amount instead?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, that's correct. It's because of the time frame and the turnaround.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Sadler has another question.
Very briefly, Ms. Wilkerson, through the chair. Did you say 112 prisoners who are age 55 and who have served at least 10 years, or just 112 who are over age 55?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, both. So there are 112 that are currently in our system that are convicted sex offenders that have met the 10-year requirement and are...
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on from number 8, we go to fiscal note number 9, Department of Corrections, Population Management, Pretrial Services, OMB 3121. Ms. Wilkerson?
Fiscal note number 9 establishes the pretrial services within the Department of Corrections. In the first year, we would anticipate a portion of the funding. We're asking for about 30% of the funding, which would be the $3.26 million, and 29 of the positions. There are three parts of the pretrial services. There is an assessment piece. There's basic supervision, which includes monitoring and regular UA testing, and then there's enhanced supervision. The overall anticipated cost, once fully implemented, would be approximately 80 positions to operate it and about $10.2 million that would come back into the department to supervise that population.
Okay. Fiscal note number 9, Representative Wilson.
Of all the fiscal notes, this one I have the biggest problems with. So we don't do any kind of assessment within the department now?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, we do. Upon sentencing, so individuals that are sentenced to incarceration for 30 days or more would receive an assessment. For the pretrial population, this assessment that they're talking about in the pretrial is a much shorter version than what any of the assessments that we currently use. It is a non-contact, it is just a review of the offender's history, their criminal history, their charges, and then it's gathering up just enough information to provide to the judge with a recommendation for prison.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
So is there a possible way that this could be a computer-generated type of program where you sit down, basically fill in all your personal information, so many questions, and then it goes in, you know, for somebody to review versus somebody maybe sitting down and filling this out?
Through the chair, I believe the commissioner might be best to speak to this right now.
Mr. Williams?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So most of these, I don't know, I haven't seen anything thus far that says you can just do it automatically, like an online, because it really is data that that someone's going to have to, you know, enter online. Most of this data, hopefully, would be online in terms of criminal record issues and things like that. So it would be, as time goes on, I think there's an expectation that we'll get better at figuring out how to gather up the data. I think it's going to require people, though, to do the assessment. I don't know of any way of automating it. But I got to tell you, there's other states that have, like I said, we had this discussion yesterday, that continue to do better. And so I'm looking for the least amount of people to do it, but I still think it's going to require, at least by virtue of the plan we have right now, the number of people to put it together and to do the assessment. So there's a piece that I think it's going to require labor to do.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, but is there a way, since you already do it upon sentencing, that can't be rolled into one assessment and just, you know, done one time here versus hiring all these new people and then you're going to do an assessment here and then have to do a second assessment? Is there any way to combine them so that we're not doing it twice? Although I know they're two different projects.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there are two different. First of all, they're dramatically different in their scope. The pretrial assessment or risk assessment done is going to be very straightforward, a very simple tool. That may lend itself to having information later, but the other assessment that's done is much more extensive in terms of when someone is sentenced, and that also deals with needs issues and is a more extensive process. So this is a very down and dirty process to determine risk at the front end without doing interviews of inmates or not even inmates, people that are charged with crimes. So there may be some way of rolling into the second assessment. We haven't done it before, so I don't want to answer that definitively. Maybe there would be, but this is real work in terms of even just doing the assessment. I think it can be centralized, possibly, but all of this requires the reason why we're given time to do this is to make sure we have the most efficient plan and sensible plan possible, and that's but it's still going to require personnel.
I want to follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So if I understand this correctly, everybody's going to go through this, even those who could pay the bail, who could afford to be out. So as we're talking about supervision and enhanced supervision, do you see that there may be a way for those who can afford to would actually be paying for that supervision or enhanced supervision? Because we're talking about everybody going through the system, not just those who are currently sitting there. Do you know if other states have said, since you can afford bail, this would be part of your bail to pay for this, just like you would for electronic monitoring?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, so the entire strategy of this is to deal with the whole bail problem, really, is to try to get away from the fact of whether or not you can afford bail, you get out. If you're a poor person, you can't afford bail, you stay in. And the goal is to turn that a little bit, to turn that ship rather dramatically, to say, regardless of whether or not you can pay the $500 or $1,000 bail, we're going to do an assessment to determine whether or not you're going to make the next court appearance and whether or not what kind of risk you represent to us until you get to your next court appearance. And that's the dramatic shift here, that if you have money, it shouldn't matter whether or not the judge should have a more objectivized standard, and that is to get rid of this problem we have right now where people sitting in jail, and oh, by the way, as the data on this area tells us, we know that this is an area that has grown dramatically in terms of our prisons. We have hundreds, thousands of people, in prison right now who are waiting to go to trial. Some of them absolutely should be in jail. But there's this other group, and then the more that you can peel them out, guess what? It's a heck of a lot cheaper to keep them out. And, oh, by the way, they're not mixing with criminals, more serious criminals. So this is a dramatic change. It gets away from the whole issue of bail being the driving factor.
Representative Wilson.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner, I really appreciate the answer, but I guess I agree with that part, but my question is to the other part, because now we're talking about from my understanding, so there won't be anybody just about bail. Everybody will go through this assessment. And some of those people who are doing the assessment can't afford, you know, to pay for the supervision or extra parts of it. So I'm not talking about those who wouldn't be able to get out otherwise. I'm glad we're going to have an avenue. But I just want to make sure that we're looking into those that can't afford. So let's say you go through it and you see they're at a medium risk, and they would have bailed themselves out anyway. They're that part. I just want to make sure there's a mechanism that if they have to be supervised, not just bail that they may have to pay, but an extra charge, just like someone who wanted to do pretrial electronic monitoring, they would have to pay for this. If you determine they need supervision or enhanced supervision, if they pay, they should. And because we're looking at this, Mr. Chairman, at growing from a $3 million fiscal note to a $10 million fiscal note. So I just want to make sure that those who can pay, that there's a mechanism for them, too. I understand those that can't. Just making sure we don't eat all the cost.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just to dovetail into the question that was just given. So you would use this risk assessment, risk tool first to kind of decide whether the person should be let out or not, but you would still impose bail if they could pay. Is that correct?
Representative Kawasaki, this is an area that I quite frankly feel much more comfortable with Nancy Mead talking about, but the judge would still have discretion about the issue of bail is not, I mean, I think it's still in line, on the line, but it is a give the courts a much more objectified tool to help the judiciary decide what in fact should happen. But the issue of what happens with the bail is an influence, kind of influence the bail schedule. I imagine it would, but I would feel much better if Nancy Mead answered that part of the question.
Representative Kawasaki?
I just want an answer.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
But I do have another question. Sorry. Oh, not on this.
Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple things. In the text of the fiscal note, it talks about establishment of regional offices in Anchorage, Juneau, and Palmer. If those were chosen because of proximity to jails, or for what reason those three were picked?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, those regions were selected initially because the judicial branches that those regions cover now, we are continuing to look at that to see if that is the most appropriate.
Okay. And then just one more.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the fiscal note on just the first page, it shows 29 full-time positions, but it actually will be an 80-position fiscal note in subsequent years. So I don't know why the little asterisk is there.
Indeterminate
after that.
Oh, it's indeterminate? Through the chair, I guess it does say that it's anticipated the full program will be 80 full-time positions, and that's what the fiscal note request of $10.1 million is for.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was going to be my question exactly, that the backup material on the back says it will require 80 full-time positions or 49 full-time without enhanced supervision, and calls for 58 positions, so I just kind of was trying to reconcile that myself. So we can anticipate more people hired, but we just don't know how many. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, yes. So what we hope to do is that through the reduction of the population, and on page 4, the very last statement, it does say that going into FY 2018, we anticipate to offset any increases in any increase up to the 80 anticipated positions by adjusting those positions from the facility out to the pretrial.
All right, thank you. I'm totally amazed on page 2. Offender assessments of 32,000 persons annually required within 24 hours. That, to me, is just amazing. Wow. Okay, further questions of fiscal note number 9? Seeing none, we'll move on to fiscal note number 10. Department of Corrections Health and Rehabilitation Services Substance Abuse Treatment Program, OMB 2974. Ms. Wilkerson.
Fiscal note number 10 increases the current substance abuse treatment programming within the institutions by $700,000 in 2017, adding an additional $300,000 for a total of $1 million carrying in through the out years to increase the treatment programs within the institutions to try and reach more of the incarcerated population.
And this is from the recidivism reduction money?
That is correct, to the chair. This is using the marijuana tax and the alcohol tax funding.
All right. Questions on fiscal note number 10? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Well, perhaps Mr. Burns is on if he's going to be on earlier. He's the director, and I guess the question comes before him in both fiscal notes. My question is, in the bill, it's using 50% of the money out of the alcohol tax goes into the recidivism reduction fund. We don't know what that is. We don't even know how much to anticipate. And the marijuana tax. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. I have I'm pending an amendment putting more increasing the percentage. But do we know if the list of things that are available to do under the recidivism reduction fund includes substance abuse, alcohol treatment, if monies used out of this fund are available outside of the recidivism, out of this program? So can they only be used in the recidivism program, reduction program, or could they be used in treatment programs outside of, to somebody not in the recidivism reduction program?
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, the language in the new version of the bill allows it to go to Department of Corrections, Behavioral Health, so it's designated to the department specific for the substance abuse treatment programming. That's my understanding currently.
Go ahead.
So, I'm sorry. So it could be used outside of the program, it goes to the Department of Corrections for those programs. So in other words, it couldn't be used outside of people in jail time. Okay.
Through the chair to represent. Yes, that's
thank
my
you.
Understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Further questions on fiscal note number 10, Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah. Thank you again, April. Yeah. Incarcerated mental health and medical health has been sort of an issue. It's a rising number for inmate health. I'm just curious, how much do we currently spend on the behavioral health side within inmate populations?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, the current behavioral health budget for FY17 and behavioral health within Department of Corrections is $8.36 million.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
No, this is just that it's a substantial increase, and I think it's well-warranted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. That's Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Just through the chair, I just want to confirm whether this fiscal note for the institutional abuse treatment programs, does that include the ones at the correctional restitution centers or just inside the other DOC facilities?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, it's only the institutions. It does not include the CRCs.
And can you give me just a brief outline of through the chair, of the number of programs and institutions and their capacity?
We do have that. And through the chair to Representative Sadler, in FY15, we had just over 600 inmates that completed the LSAT program, and we had just over 150 that completed the RSAT program within a correctional center while incarcerated.
Could you please spell those acronyms out? Or
the LSAT is a short term. It's called Life Skills Substance Abuse Treatment, which I believe we recently changed the name of that one. And then RSAT is residential substance abuse treatment. It's a longer-term substance abuse program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. And that will complete fiscal note number 10. Ms. Wilkerson, I appreciate you being here today, and Commissioner Williams online, and Ms. Cunningham for being here for also to help us out through those. Our next group will be fiscal notes 11 through 14. Here to go over the Department of Health and Social Services fiscal notes are Ms. Diane Casto and she's from the Division of Health Policy Advisory, and Mr. Matt Davidson, the Program Coordinator for the Division of Juvenile Justice. If you would please come before us, place yourselves on the record, and we'll start in with fiscal note number 11. We also have Tony Piper online with the Alcohol Safety Action Program Manager to answer questions. So we'll begin with fiscal note number 11, Department of Health and Social Services, Behavioral Health Treatment and Recovery Grants, OMB 3099.
Good afternoon. Diane Casto, Behavioral Health Policy Advisor for the Department of Health and Social Services. And with the committee's indulgence, it would be beneficial if I could go through fiscal note 11 and 14 at the same time, because they're tied to the same thing. One is using Medicaid dollars and one is using the recidivism fund, but they're for the same activities.
That will probably be fine.
Okay, thank you.
We'll get there.
Make it a little more consistent.
All right, continue.
Okay, so these two fiscal notes really are for the same thing. Therefore, much of the work that we talked about in yesterday's hearing related to the community work that we're doing in reentry, particularly with the reentry center in Anchorage, the Partners Reentry Center, as well as the current four community reentry coalitions that are in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Matsu, as well as four developing community reentry coalitions in Dillingham, Nome, Bethel, and Kenai. So a total of eight community reentry coalitions and one reentry center. So if you look at the second page of the fiscal note, you will see the kind of services that we are talking about. And again, on both fiscal notes, they are the same services. So as we talked again yesterday, we talked about how the center is working to get direct referrals from the from our institutions as people are coming out, and then the reentry center helps them find jobs, get training, find housing, you know, get referrals for treatment and services. The coalitions are still in a more grassroots developing stage, but the hope is that through the next few years, they will, like I said, four of them are currently doing assessments of the capacity in their community, and then we'll be working to develop that capacity as well as to start kind of shifting from a coalition to actually helping develop in each of those communities an actual reentry center where people coming out of our institutions will be able to be referred and get actual services at the center as well as good referral to the community service system. So that's what these funds are about. So if you look at the two fiscal notes, fiscal note 11 is starts with $1 million in fiscal year 17 using the recidivism reduction fund, and that will go kind of be spread among the groups that I just talked about, helping give some funding specifically for the Partners Reentry Center in Anchorage, and then for the Ford coalitions that are currently being funded through with some startup money from the Alaska Mental Health Trust. This will assist them in broadening their ability to do work and then getting some additional startup money for the additional four reentry centers. Certainly, as we go through time, if other communities start developing reentry centers, we will be happy and willing to work with them as well. So then in year year, let's see, in fiscal year 18, it goes up to $2 million using the recidivism reduction funding. And then from year 19, fiscal year 19 through 22, that's where the second fiscal note comes in, where we are able to reduce the amount of funding on the fiscal note 11 down to $1.625 million in recidivism reduction, matching it with the money in fiscal year 14, where we are using $375,000 of recidivism reduction funding to leverage an additional $1.25 million in federal Medicaid match. So in the years, the outlying years, as our Medicaid reform takes effect, we will then be able to leverage those dollars, so we'll have additional funding for at the community level through these funds. Now, with that said, there are also a couple of other things that we again hit on yesterday briefly that will help broaden the ability of communities to provide these services, such as through some of the changes in the behavioral health reform and through a possible 1115 waiver, where it will allow us to increase the kind of services that we can bill for Medicaid, such as possible, and these are all possible at this point, there's no decisions have been made, but some of the transitional housing, some of the case management, some of the working with people, peer support services. And then the other thing that will help in broadening our ability to maximize these dollars is the change that is anticipated to take away the current regulation that you can only bill Medicaid as a provider if you have a behavioral health grant. And that is part of what will be that it is anticipated, that's going to be part of the reform, where we're going to change the regulation so you don't have to have a grant in order to bill Medicaid, so it will open it up for private providers and other nonprofits that currently do not have a grant. So when you put the two together, we actually, it would be a total of, in the out years of 19 through 22, it'll be, let me do my addition really fast.
3.1.
Yeah, thank you very much. So again, instead of the $2 million, we'll get to leverage those Medicaid dollars and add to that through that capacity. So I'll leave it at that and take
any
questions.
We'll come back. We'll start right here with questions of Ms. Casto, Representative Sadler, Wilson, Kawasaki.
Thank you,
Sadler.
Mr. Chair, through the most amazing coincidence, we have correctional restitution centers, community residential centers, I've heard, and now I think community reentry center. That's my question.
Coalition.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
But so the reentry centers that we're speaking of here are not the CRCs referenced elsewhere that are correctional restitution centers. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes. They are a community-based program to support where as people come out of the system, and when I say out of the system, in most cases, these are not the ones that are still on supervision through a CRC. They are ones that are released. They are done serving their time. They are moving forward with their lives, and they are then referred to a community, either the center and, at this point, the coalitions, which hopefully we will start developing more centers.
Thank you. And
follow up, Representative Kat Sadler.
Following up on page 2 of fiscal note 14, there is says there is currently just one reentry center operating in Alaska. Is that the Pathways?
Through the chair, no. That would be the Partners Reentry Center, which is part of Partners for Progress in Anchorage.
Partners Reentry. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I missed this somewhere. How much is in the recidivism fund right now?
Through the chair, I don't know that, but since we haven't started selling marijuana, I'm going to assume zero.
For the follow-up?
Because it would be taxes.
Okay,
because I thought you just said, that's what I thought, until I thought I heard you say that Mental Health Trust was going to begin this fund to start with, since there is zero in it. Did I miss here?
Through the chair, a little bit. So currently we have the four coalitions in Anchorage, Matsu, Juneau, and Fairbanks. They started, they've been kind of at a grassroots process for a while. And this year, we, through the Mental Health Trust, we were able to give them, we, the trust, and in partnership with Corrections, were able to give them a $100,000 grant to hire a coordinator, and then they're one of the outcomes that they need to perform for that money is to conduct a thorough community assessment of the services, the gaps, the needs, what, how many individuals they think that they will be serving, those kind of things. So currently, the trust is funding this year $100,000 for those community coalitions. Next year, our hope is to expand some of those funds and to expand them to the other four developing coalitions.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
So this, I'm not sure where to ask this question at, because so much of this, in fact, about $6,336,000 in these fiscal notes are all based on the recidivism fund, which there's zero in. So does this plan not, I mean, is there someone that's going to come before us with some kind of estimate of how much tax dollars that they think they're going to get out of marijuana? Because, I mean, this whole thing is based on this fund that there's nothing in.
Ms. Cunningham, could you come up and join them at the table, please?
Thank you.
Pull the microphone over to and place yourself on the record again so that the secretary knows what's going on.
For the, my name is Kelly Cunningham. I'm a fiscal analyst at Legislative Finance. Through the chair, so I am not the expert on this. I will give a basic summary. The Recidivism Reduction Fund is created in the bill. It is basing its estimates on the revenue sources book from the Department of Revenue. There, that was a wide range when they estimated how much tax they would collect from marijuana. It was anywhere from $3 million to $30 million. I believe they landed on $12 million in the revenue book. These fiscal notes for FY17 estimate, they utilized $3 million of the Recidivism Reduction Fund, which would equal anticipated $6 million collected in FY17.
Representative Wilson, follow up on
follow
that.
Follow up, and yeah, and I'm sorry, I had $3,260,000 that was actual general fund. So what happens if this isn't right? I mean, because we have to have the background checks, which is still in this bill. It'll take a while to get all that portions on it. Maybe it's a bill sponsor question when we get to that. It still looks like we're going to get $3 million in general funds. What happens if this other isn't realized? So maybe at the end, we could just find out what happens if we don't do as well in marijuana as we think we might. I mean, it just seems kind of really sorrowful that, you know, we're going to depend this whole system on how profitable marijuana happens to be in the state. I guess maybe that's where I'm having more issues with. I'm done.
All right. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks for being here today on this beautiful day. Question on, so the reentry coalitions currently, are they 501c3 organizations?
Through the chair, that's a really good question, and the answer is some yes, some no. So what, if you know anything about how community coalitions work, often, most often, they're grassroots organization. They grow up and they're not organized in any way other than a passionate group of people that want to make some change. So what we have right now is, I believe, of the four coalitions that we have, one of them is a 501c3. The others have a fiscal agent that is one of the coalition members that is serving as the fiscal agent to collect the money, that the grant money from the Alaska Mental Health Trust. If they choose to become themselves a reentry center, they would have to become a nonprofit, but in many cases, the coalition may stay as a more grassroots coalition, and they may work to establish a reentry center for their community.
Thank you. I guess, is it anticipated that other organizations, like I know in Fairbanks, Tanana Chiefs Conference has talked about starting a reentry style coalition? Would they be able to take advantage of grant funds through your agency under this?
Through the chair, absolutely. Our intent is that we want to be able to help people develop these centers as needed and where they're needed and as they're needed. So, you know, of course, with limited funds, we will have to manage how that looks. But, you know, because we don't see ourselves as 100% funding any of either the center reentry centers or the coalitions. We see ourselves as providing them funds to help them move forward. Now, one of the things, again, with some of the behavioral health and Medicaid reform is that many of these people, if we get them Medicaid eligible, we will be able to bill, and some of the services that are currently provided by the Anchorage reentry center, such as case management, some of the peer services, would be able to be billed down the road, and they are currently not.
Just one more.
One more, Representative Kalasak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So essentially, the department would be more of just a simple granting agency, I guess. Is that the way you would see it, or would you have some other hand in, because it's going to be up to $3.125 million by FY20. Does the department anticipate taking any of that, or would it all just basically go pass through to agencies that you've approved?
Through the chair, this is all passed through to the agencies. The work will be done with the existing staff.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. That basically covers fiscal note number 11 and 14. We're going to move to number 12. Ms. Castro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will start number 12, and I believe Tony Piper is online, and if he wants to add anything, he can certainly do that, but I will give it a start. Interestingly, as I mentioned yesterday, I've been on the job. This is my third week, and day number 3 I was doing fiscal notes, so these fiscal notes. So I'm fairly intimate with them. Okay, so fiscal note number 12 it relates to the changes within the bill, SB 91, related to the current ASAP program. And one of the things that the bill talks about, and I didn't bring my bill with me, so I don't know the exact areas. Oh, no, I guess it's in here, isn't it? Sections 152 and 153. Excellent. That where we're trying to make a slight change to and more definition to who will be coming into ASAP. Right now it's kind of opened up to anyone who the courts say should be going, any alcohol-related incident. So it's a wide range. It's kind of, you know, the various levels of risk or need for services. And so the whole plan for ASAP in the future with this passage of this bill is to narrow the definitions of who specifically will be referred to ASAP, and that there will be a more prescriptive process for assessment and referral to services and then monitoring. So what this fiscal note is will relate to making sure that we have a good quality assessment tool. We're looking at the LSIR screening version, which we talked about the LSIR yesterday, and I do remember someone asked what that stood for, and it is the level of services inventory. The R is for revised. So just so you know, facts you may need sometime. So we are going to be looking at using that, and what we will be doing is using these funds to buy the screening tool materials, to do training, and to do training not only with our Anchorage state staff who do operate the Anchorage ASAP office, but all of the, I believe, 12 ASAP offices that are out in our other communities and rural areas. So it will be for training, for obtaining the screening tool, and then ongoing keeping staff up to speed on how to use this and how best to implement it. Currently, we currently use sometimes the LSIR, not the screening version, and we do have a good working relationship with the Department of Corrections and their LSIR trainers, so we're hoping to continue to partner with them to have them assist us with training all of our staff around the state. So with that, I will, it is $30,000.3 for fiscal year 17, and then 29.2 on the outgoing years for maintaining for staff turnover and keeping, you know, keeping people up to speed on the ability to do and use this training tool or the screening tool. And with that, I would ask if Tony Piper has any additional information he would like to add.
Mr. Piper, the Alcohol Safety Action Program Manager, Division of Behavioral Health, you're online. Would you place yourself on the record? Do you have anything to add to Ms. Casto's remarks?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is Tony Piper. I'm the ASAP Program Manager. I'm here in Anchorage. And the only thing I would add is that I think Ms. Casto did an excellent job. The first year we do have to buy manuals. It decreases, the fiscal note decreases every year after that, because once the manuals are purchased, that would be the one-time purchase for those. The other costs are, just like Ms. Casto said, the minimal training that would take place, and the purchase of the tool itself, which are, copyrighted tools. And that's what the cost, entails totally.
All right. Committee questions of Mr. Piper and Ms. Casto. Seeing none, that will. Oh, Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. So, having not read sections 153, 151, 2, and 3 thoroughly, so that does change the criteria. I'm trying to read. Help me, Ms. Casto, understand how the requirements for who has to submit to the ASAP test changes under these three sections, which implies the changes in the cost of the fiscal note.
Through the chair, I will defer to Mr. Piper, since he does manage the program and will have more specific information on that question.
Mr. Piper.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler, the change will eliminate some of the people that are being charged with crimes other than what are statutorily required, minor consumings, DUI offenders, certain drug offenders that have to do with licensing, and they're very specific charges now, as opposed to just pretty much anything that was alcohol or drug-related misdemeanors at one point. The changes for the office are now, instead of just doing a substance use assessment, which is what we've done in the past, we just screened for substance use. Now we will do the full risk assessment screening to determine the risk of reoffense for other participants, the smaller amount of participants, and then monitor those people and make sure that they follow through with the requirements that the court mandates for them.
So to restate, Mr. Piper, make sure, so you're going to be doing fewer tests, but you're going to target those fewer tests to those who are specifically charged with drug or alcohol-related charges, and you're going to do more thorough tests.
That's the point. That's what we're going to do.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Piper, Ms. Casto, Ms. Cunningham, for helping us get through numbers 11, 12, and 14. We're going to move to fiscal note number 13 at this time, Department of Health and Social Services Juvenile Justice Probation Services, OMB 2134. Mr. Davidson, place yourself on the record.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Matt Davidson, a program coordinator with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Again, the division is submitting a zero fiscal note for this component and for the bill as a whole. I'll note that the commission did not really consider juvenile impacts on juvenile offenders, and so we've been monitoring this bill to look at the minimal impacts that the provisions have. Again, juveniles were not the focus of the commission's work, and the legislature didn't instruct them to look at juvenile offenders. If you'd like me to, I can go through the few minor impacts programmatically that the bill has on juveniles. If not,
if you would, please.
Yeah, sure. So the changes in the felony monetary levels for property crimes affects juvenile offenders. So overall, the division has referred youth who commit crimes that would be crimes if they're an adult. And so if a juvenile commits a property crime and it's a felony level, they would come in as a felony versus a misdemeanor. It doesn't really change how the division necessarily would handle them. We handle juvenile offenders based upon their risk and need rather than just the level of offense. The second major provision is the reduction of a handful of misdemeanors into violations. Our statute gives us authority over criminal offenses, so minors who commit criminal offenses, if it's a violation, it's not considered a criminal offense any longer. So we have there's a handful of offenses in the bill that would become violations and be handled by the courts directly, become citations, and they'd go to court and pay a fine, and they would no longer be in our jurisdiction. That has no impact on us, mostly because those offenses are rarely referred to the division: gambling, dogfighting, etc. They're not; those aren't our major. Kids aren't doing those things as a rule. The third provision is prostitution. The changes to the victim being a victim of sex trafficking. Again, we see very few prostitution referrals from law enforcement. If we do see those referrals, we are already referring those kids basically as victims. And they often come in on other charges, but they happen to be also working the sex trade. And so we try and get them services outside of the division usually, and they're not generally adjudicated for prostitution. It's very, very rare. Those are the three major components that really affect juveniles, and we think we can handle everything within our current budget.
Any questions on fiscal note number 13? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Davidson. And we will move on to fiscal note number 15. Fiscal note 15 will be Department of Law. Mr. John Skidmore, Division Director for the Criminal Division. Fiscal note 15, Department of Law, Criminal Division, Criminal Justice Legation, OMB 2202. Mr. Skidmore's online. Mr. Skidmore, please place yourself on the record and walk us through fiscal note number 15.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the Alaska Department of Law. Fiscal note 15, as you have it numbered at the top, is the fiscal note from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law for SB 91. I can tell you that we originally provided an indeterminate fiscal note when the bill was in the other body there. When it went through the other body's Finance Committee, it was changed to a zero fiscal note, which is what you see in front of you today. The difficulty for the Department of Law in providing a exact number is there are some areas in which the Criminal Division anticipates there will be additional work. There are other areas in which we anticipate there will be a reduction in work. And while we anticipate both an increase and a reduction in different areas, it is very difficult to quantify either the increase or the reduction. And when you have both of them and can't really quantify either of them, it makes it very difficult to come up with a precise number. That having been said, what we've indicated in the fiscal note now, as was discussed in the Finance Committee for the other body, is that the Department of Law will attempt to absorb any of the costs that are associated with the bill. I'll walk you through briefly the comments that we have, and then I'm happy to take any questions. The first area deals with sentence lengths. In felony cases, there are additional procedural requirements for them. There is the requirement for a grand jury. There are sentencing components that involve aggravators or misdemeanors, that is, pleadings that have to be filed in those cases. And there's also something called a pre-sentence report, which is generally prepared in those cases, and so those sentencings tend to be more involved and can involve additional litigation. When you reduce certain crimes from felonies to misdemeanors, for example, the increase in the felony property thresholds, as well as reducing possession of all controlled substances to misdemeanors, that reduces the amount of work that needs to be done. However, in misdemeanor cases, it used to be we did not have to present aggravators or mitigators. SB 91 will change that so that we would now have to file notice of aggravators as well as potentially present some of those aggravators to a jury. How much of that will occur, we cannot anticipate, and that's why it's difficult to provide an exact number, but as indicated, we will attempt to absorb those costs. The second area is bail reform. There are dramatic changes that are made to the way in which bail is conducted in the state. More individuals should be released automatically on bail, and that will hopefully reduce the number of hearings. However, there is also a new requirement that does a 180-degree turn from what the current law says, which is about the ability or inability to post bail. Under current law, courts are not allowed to consider that. Under SB 91, they now would be required to consider that for a second bail hearing if a person is unable to post bail. We cannot anticipate how many additional hearings that may result in. We just don't know right now. So we can't tell if there's an increase in the overall number of hearings, if there's a decrease in the overall number of hearings. We just don't know. Also, as it relates to bail, we are shifting to a method of using risk assessments. And while the Department of Law is very, very supportive of using risk assessments, because they are not yet developed, we don't know what that will look like. We don't know what litigation may result from a new method of determining bail. I can tell the committee that the bail statutes were changed several years ago, and as a result of changes made at that time, there was litigation that resulted from those changes. So history certainly tells us that when we make changes, there is often initial litigation and then it sort of dies down. I can't tell you if that repeats in these reforms. I just don't know. But that's certainly something that is a possibility. That's on page 2 of 3 for our fiscal note. On page 3, the notes talk about other changes that are made in the law. Again, for each one of those, we don't anticipate a fiscal impact, but again, anytime there are changes, sometimes there are unintended consequences or unintended results, and so we're just not sure. As a result, overall, the department has presented a zero fiscal note, as we will attempt to absorb any additional costs that there may be. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Many have any questions of Mr. Skidmore? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore, for being here. I mean, I'm reading the in between the lines, and actually I'm reading some of the lines that say just an increased workload to prove the aggravators, mitigators, increased workload potentially from the ability to have a second trial or a second hearing for bail. I know you've given us a zero fiscal note, but there is work attached to this bill that either your department will try to absorb or extra money that you might need in a future year. Is that safe to say?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, what is difficult about this is that we anticipate that there is a possibility of additional work, but we don't know how much work. But at the same time, and I need to emphasize this, we also know there will be some reductions in areas where we are putting in effort now. And so I also can't tell you what that offset will be. So I just really can't predict for you if there is an overall increase or not. I expect an increase in some areas. I expect a decrease in some other areas. I don't know how those will compare and whether or not overall the workload increases. So again, that's why it's a zero at the moment, but we did originally submit an indeterminate because we just weren't sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions of Mr. Skidmore on fiscal note number 15? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Skidmore, for being online with us today. Next, we're going to go to the two Department of Public Safety fiscal notes. Fiscal note number 16, we have Ms. Kelly Howell online, Division Director of Administrative Services. She'll walk us through the fiscal note. It's fiscal note number 16, Department of Public Safety, Alaska State Troopers, Alaska State Trooper Detachments, OMB number 2325. Ms. Howell, please place yourself on the record and walk us through fiscal note number 16.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell, and I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Public Safety. I'll be very brief. I do want to let you also know that I have Gary Folger, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, with me here as well. The Division of Alaska State Troopers does not initially foresee any direct fiscal impact from SB 91 and therefore has submitted a zero fiscal note. Any additional questions, I would be happy to entertain.
Representative Kawasaki has a question, Ms. Howell.
Thank you. Because I know you're familiar, up in Fairbanks we have a halfway house that can't seem to keep its people in, and I know that there's several times where state troopers have had to go out and find these people. I mean, just in recent history, probably a dozen in the last year. Is that a potential impact, seeing as how these residential centers or restitution centers will be growing?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, for the record, my name is Gary Folger, Commissioner for Public Safety. I am very familiar with what you're talking about. We're very hopeful that EM will address some of these issues.
Follow up, Representative Kawasaki?
That's good enough.
Further questions from the Commissioner or from Ms. Howell? Seeing none, that's fiscal note number 16. We're going to move on to fiscal note 17. We have Ms. Lori Morton, the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She will speak to this fiscal note. It's fiscal note 17, Department of Public Safety, Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, OMB number 521. Ms. Morton, please place yourself on the record and talk to us about fiscal note 17.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Our fiscal note primarily goes to crime prevention services, section 195 of the bill on page 118 and 119 adds uncodified language requiring the council to expand or create violence prevention and victim service programming. It's in direct response to the victim service roundtables I spoke of yesterday and the impact and influence they had in the commission's overall report, adding recommendation number 21 to address victim services and in some of their priorities. So we it started out, as I also mentioned yesterday, at $2.5 million with the necessity to reduce that to $1 million. We wanted to keep the same complement of services, but it will restrict the manner in which we're able to have those services start going out into communities. So we'll be doing, for example, fewer communities with Green Dot. We'll have fewer communities able to add Girls on the Run into their complement of programming, fewer communities being able to do Coaching Boys into Men, but we want to keep the full complement. We believe it's very important to continue comprehensive ways in which communities can influence their individual citizens, groups, and the community as a whole. So we'll support community readiness efforts to build prevention plans. We will look at Green Dot going into more communities. We think it's very important to evaluate what's working so that we can know that it's evidence-based and working, and if something happens not to work, we can course correct early enough in the programming to be able to ensure that it's for the benefit of the community as a whole. And you'll notice in FY 2020, the services line is increased, and that's so we can have our 10-year look back with the Alaska Victimization Survey in order to be able to, we hope, see diminishing domestic violence and sexual assault in our state and be further down the road of proving that these primary prevention efforts are working.
Representative Sadler has a question, Ms. Morton.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Morton, third paragraph down on page 2 of the fiscal note, what is Lead On for Peace and Equality? What's their goals?
Lead On for Peace and Equality is a statewide conference that is youth-led, adult-supported. It's a three-day conference, and with youth leaders from across the state apply to attend. They craft ways in which they can be initiators in their communities for different activities and programming that they believe will lead to peaceful communities. So after the end of the 3 days, they have projects and plans that they go back into their community to implement. We have a small program. I don't know that we really have a name for it. It's mini grants So these youth leaders can apply for $2,500 to help them implement some of their projects in their home community. And then throughout the year, they have various teleconferences or webinars or ways in which they can stay connected and then continue to build their community of leadership. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't say through the chair.
That's okay, through the chair. So it's youth-led, adult-guided. They craft ways to support peace and equality in terms of personal relationships or national relationships or...
It's personal relationships, but it's their community relationships. It applies not only to domestic violence and sexual assault, but suicide prevention, for example, substance abuse prevention, for example. It's really ways in which they're helping their community blend to be healthy and respectful to one another. So it touches all those areas.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. That's good.
Representative Calagera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm able to watch most of this from downstairs. If you could tell me, so is there also anything on better intervention in this fiscal note, or that's not part of this?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, no, that's not part of this.
Okay. And through the Chair.
Guerra.
I think I know the answer to this, but just to make sure, there was a cut over last year in the Girls on the Run, Boys on the Run program, and the... Boys into Men program, and so the $1 million that you're asking for in FY17 for all these programs, that reflects the understanding that there was a cut, right? So it's the right number.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, in fiscal year 15, we had $2.75 million that we were able to allocate to prevention activities, including the research, the Alaska Victimization Survey. That was reduced through the operating budget process for FY16. We only had a little less than $500,000. In FY17, we have no funds in the operating budget for prevention activities at all. We had 9 staff in FY17. Our staff has been reduced by 3. We were expecting 2, which was an office assistant and a program coordinator. We were not expecting to lose the 3rd position, so it's going to be difficult. The $1 million was derived from the realization in the other body that I believe I mentioned yesterday, the desire to show more of a savings than a recognition that those savings could be turned back into the programming, so the reinvestment portion. So we had adjusted down our fiscal note accordingly. So from FY15 at 2.7 million, we're down in FY17 if this fiscal note goes through to 1 million for those same activities. It at least allows us to continue.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell me in, FY18, $2 million, how much of that will go directly to the community programs that you mentioned?
1.6.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we have $1,600,000 set in there for grants that would go directly out into communities.
Okay.
Follow up, Representative Munoz.
And the balance, the $400,000, would go for?
We have $50,000 in travel. About $5,000 of that would be our staff, but $45,000 of that would be community members. It's a cost savings to be able to consolidate the travel that's arranged in our office, but it's for community members to get together. Then there's $50,000 in commodities. It's also more efficient for our office to produce materials to send out to everyone instead of having each individual program have to purchase their own materials. And then $300,000 is in I'm sorry, I got my line. No, that's all right. $300,000 is in services, and that's going to be for some of the evaluation that we're working with independent evaluators and supporting them going into communities, working directly with the communities on evaluating the different parts of their projects and activities they've instituted, as well as some joint activities between communities. So that would be, we would contract that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, earlier we had to make the difficult decision in the Budget Subcommittee, Department of Public Safety, to reduce your administrative staff from 9 down to 6, if I remember correctly. And I guess the fiscal note assumes that this work will be done with a smaller amount of staff, the 6 staff.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes, it does.
Okay, thank you.
We've been joined by Representative Vasquez in the office. You're in the office. Audience. In the audience. This is our big office here. So. Okay, further questions of fiscal note number 17. Ms. Morton, thank you very much. Okay, we're going to plow on to fiscal notes number 18 and 19. Here to go over the Judiciary Court's fiscal notes is General Counsel Ms. Nancy Mead. Fiscal note number 18, Judiciary Alaska Court System Trial Courts, OMB 768. We'll do that one first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. The court system submitted a zero fiscal note on SB 91. I guess the comments you heard previously from both the Department of Law and the Public Defender reflect our thinking as well. This will likely result in more work and more hearings in some areas and hopefully less work and fewer hearings in other areas. Again, the others before me said that the changes to the bail statute will be are comprehensive. We anticipate more defendants asking for a bail review hearing because now the inability to pay is grounds to get another hearing. The whole changes to the bail statute will include a lot of work up front to coordinate and interface with the Department of Corrections Pretrial Services Office. As the chair pointed out, they're going to be doing 32,000 reports on individuals who are arrested and somehow getting those to the court within 24 hours. And I anticipate that we'll be working hard in the next 18 months. So that is not something with a fiscal impact per se. That is, we are not going to hire somebody to do it, but people are in our administrative staff, like me, will be working hours with the Department of Corrections to make that coordination work well. And we'll have to use people in our IS department, for example, to set up maybe an email accounts to send those reports to, or an web interface or something. So it does impact our workload, but not in such a way that we would need additional resources to do it. There are changes to the probation provisions. People can get a probation termination hearing, and we expect those to be to result in more probation hearings. And there are changes in the types of violations that can lead to a petition to revoke probation. And again, I'm thinking that that will be a lot more probation, PTRP, we call them, petition to revoke probation hearings. So that will be, again, increased workload to the court. As, again, others have said, the change in the misdemeanor law so that aggravators and mitigators may be proven will likely lead to more hearings or mini trials on those facts that may lead one to conclude that the misdemeanor should be aggravated or mitigated. On the other hand, some felonies are becoming misdemeanors, and it's generally less work to process a misdemeanor than a felony, and some misdemeanors will become violations, which is generally less work. Violations do have a court appearance. None of these will be the type of violations where you can just send in your money, but generally that's less work than a misdemeanor. That again, as the Department of Law mentioned, whenever there's a comprehensive change in laws like this, there's the probability that many of these provisions will be litigated and lead to, for example, a few appellate cases. Until the vagaries get ironed out, that's something that will increase workload. And There are a couple of provisions in the bill, such as the change to the credit to time served, credit for time served parameters, and what the judge can consider in order to grant that, that I believe will lead to many more hearings, what are called Nigrin hearings or 027 hearings, and that will be, again, an increase in workload until that sort of gets ironed out and more established in the law. The changes to the limited license provisions may or may not result in additional hearings, depending on what happens with that. But on the whole, we think that it will be more or less a wash, and it will, though, increase our workload. Probably, it will be something that we can just absorb without asking for additional resources. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
On fiscal note number 18, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm still having trouble understanding on the treatment portion of it. Why you think there's going to be more hearings?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you're talking about the changes to AS 1255-027, the credit for time served, for time spent in a treatment program. Right now, the statute is sets out strict guidelines for what a program has to be like in order for the judge to grant the credit. And so if a program has certain characteristics, the judge does grant the credit for time spent in that treatment program. The change that was put in by the last committee takes away those definite strict constraints so that you can look at a program and just know if it complies, and makes and says the judge shall consider the following 10 factors in deciding whether to grant credit for time served. And the factors are things like whether it's residential or not, and that's easy to say whether one is or not, but the extent to which electronic monitoring is used. Or they're not well-defined, they are vaguer. And when things are vague, that means that there's room for argument about what's going on with the treatment program. Right now, everybody knows in different communities which treatment programs fit the parameters of that statute. And so there isn't the hearings to get your credit do not take a very long time, because everybody knows you were in this program. The judge, the defense attorney, and the prosecutor all know that that is a program that fits the parameters of the statute. With new parameters that are vague, people will certainly argue about whether a program fits the statute or not. And that's why I anticipate seeing more hearings under that.
And a follow-up.
Representative Wilson.
But hopefully as they go along and they have success rates or whatever, you know, you would hope to see out of the programs, do you see that there won't be as much argument as it will become defined as more people utilize certain programs that may not currently be underneath those specific provisions?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, when the court is determining whether a program is one that it fits the statute and therefore the person gets credit for time spent in that program, the court makes no determination about the effectiveness or the whether the treatment is successful or not. It's day for day. If the program has certain characteristics, the person gets day-to-day treatment. There is not a determination as to whether the person achieved sobriety or was in any way rehabilitated.
Wow, that's kind of not good. So follow up. I don't know how we measure some of these, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure we do that. So besides having more hearings, and maybe you're not the right person to ask this, but you know, we've gone around and around throughout this entire session talking about behavioral health and all the issues that we have. Is it possible that adding this language that opens it up a little bit more could hopefully offer more programs, people to take programs that aren't filled up? Because that's our problem. We have programs that are filled, and people just can't get into them because they're filled up. And I think it is the hopes that there might be other good programs out there that people might not be taking advantage of because they can't get credit for them. Does a good outweigh the possible extra hearings?
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is certainly a question for the legislature. I have discussed my concerns about the increased hearings with the maker of the amendment, and his hope is certainly that more programs will qualify under the amendment. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but that's for you guys.
Representative Wilson.
Well, I appreciate that, and I guess it's kind of interesting because we have all these things that we're putting together, and if we're not measuring the right things, and I'm not even sure through which program, whether you do it through DOC or you do it through courts or you know, public safety to make sure, or health and social services, but I guess maybe that's one of the determinations that we might be able to hear from sponsor on, you know, if this legislation passes, who exactly is going to come back to us to let us know what's going well, what's not going well, and making sure that we're keeping the right statistics. But I did not realize that we didn't measure good programs or how they got credit through the success, but thank you.
So Chair Newman on that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the programs that I worked on along with Ms. Mead was the recidivism reduction plan. And when we did that, the Mental Health Trust put some money forward to create a database or a library built within the university system that would track what type of different treatment programs are used and how they're used, which ones were effective. What may be effective in Juneau may not work in Fairbanks or Anchorage or Bethel. And so the ability, you're right, Representative Wilson, we need to absolutely have the ability to know what and how we're spending our money. And so that's why the methodology was created to do that, so we didn't waste the funds for treatment.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, obviously there's a hesitance in this committee to change fiscal notes with the bill that we want to pass. So, I mean, that's an undercurrent that's going on here. Ms. Mead, part of what the court system does, and my understanding is the funds to do it, even though they might be behavioral health, they flow through the court. Part of what the court system does in cases like this is therapeutic courts, alternative courts programs that you have. Is that correct?
That's correct. We do have therapeutic courts through the chair.
And through the chair, we've always heard those things are under capacity for the court system to address as many folks as you'd like. Under this bill, will you be doing more through the therapeutic courts and maybe it's the next fiscal note, I'm not sure, but will you be doing more through the therapeutic courts, or if we leave the funding flat, will you not be able to do more through the therapeutic courts to get more offenders into the therapeutic courts to achieve the benefits that therapeutic courts provide?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I appreciate the question, and therapeutic courts is actually the only program in the state that has been evaluated for its effectiveness through a judicial council study, and it's shown to be effective, not 100% certainly, but it is. It does have very positive evaluations for those who go through the program and graduate. This bill, as I see this bill, it doesn't touch therapeutic courts except for the limited license provision that says you can apply for a limited license if you've been through therapeutic courts. It's the hope of the court that may be an incentive or motivate more people to enroll in therapeutic courts. We could use more people who want to do therapeutic courts. We have openings in most of the courts. In Fairbanks, we don't, but it's a very good balance. There's you know, it varies by day, but there aren't really openings, but there's not a wait list. It's very close in Fairbanks. In the rest of the state, we could use more people who are motivated to go through those courts. They are hard programs. They're 18 months. And when people are facing, for example, 4 months in jail or 18 months in a therapeutic court, many choose not to go through therapeutic court. It's a grueling program that starts off with 5 days a week meetings. You know, it goes less and less as the 18 months goes on. But we are anxious to get more people into therapeutic court. So the only parts of this bill that might help that are that limited license provision, and maybe it will motivate somebody to go through it so that they can eventually get their license back. And the pretrial service office is generally charged with recommending to the court whether the person would be a good candidate for diversion programs, which can include therapeutic court. So maybe raising the awareness with the defendant or with people that this might be a good candidate could be helpful.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two other things, if I could. And then on the zero fiscal note, you're sort of like the public defenders and those other agencies. You only have a certain number of statutory judges. It's not like you can go on your own to hire another judge, so you're just going to have to absorb that within the number of judges, and the judge has a clerk, and so that's why it's a zero fiscal note.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, that's right. Even if we, with many bills, when we see an increased workload, it's not the case that we can say, and therefore we need another judge. For one thing, a judge sits in one locations in the one location, and the increased workload will be spread across all of our judges. And so trying to, you know, submit very credible fiscal notes, we usually say we can absorb that, and that's the case here. But I do think that it will be more work for individual judges, which will impact, you know, the justice system. We don't need additional resources to implement this bill.
And then finally, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah. And then just going back to therapeutic courts, this is a little bit, it's half off the fiscal note. I think maybe other people might be interested. I know I am. With the reforms on Medicaid that leverage extra behavioral health grants, drug treatment grants, alcohol abuse grants, will there be more prisoners who qualify for those grants that would allow you to expand the use of therapeutic courts if you need to? Or do you not know?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, therapeutic courts happen independently of prison and instead of prison in almost every situation. And so a person pleads guilty and is put into goes into therapeutic court with the consent of the DA, the PD, the judge, DBH, and many players. And it doesn't touch the prison system, to my knowledge, in most cases. Did I avoid your question? And I'm sorry if I did.
Through the chair.
Yeah, Guerra.
What I meant to ask, and I can't remember whether being a prisoner disqualifies you for some Medicaid services, but will there be more behavioral health funds through Medicaid for that population who might want to avail themselves of the therapeutic court system? Or if you don't know, that's fine.
And through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't know, but I do know that the people in therapeutic money is not an obstacle for people in therapeutic courts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you, Nancy. The fiscal note says that on balance, the workload will balance out. There will be more hearings in some cases, but less hearings perhaps in other areas. But we do know that the courts will face half-day court closures in the coming year and mandatory furloughs. So considering those changes and what you said about the, you know, the added workload per judge, have you analyzed what those specific changes in your budget going forward will have with this added workload?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, and I do appreciate that question, but again, like some of the prior testifiers, it's very speculative what's going to happen under this bill. And though we can anticipate likely more hearings for this and more for that, we have not done the analysis of where those would take place, how we're going to handle it. You are correct. We're also down 50 employees, for example, and the clerk's offices are very busy. But one bill didn't cause us to say we can justify hiring, you know, six different clerks and spread them around the state, because we just don't know yet what will happen with that workload.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And that concludes fiscal note number 18. Ms. Mead, we're going to move to fiscal note 19. Judiciary, Judicial Council, OMB, component number 771. Ms. Mead, are you doing 77, number 19 now?
I believe you should. Do you have Suzanne DiPietro on the phone?
Suzanne DiPietro.
Who are we going to? Suzanne DiPietro. I can't pronounce myself very well. Please place yourself on the record and lead us through fiscal note 19.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. The Judicial Council has submitted a fiscal note for SB 91, and our note is in connection to our responsibility to staff the work of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, which is work that we're doing right now. And so the fiscal note is mostly a continuation of the funding that the legislature provided us to staff the commission to date. However, we are asking for a small increase to reflect additional duties that will fall to the commission in this note. So the commission under this bill will be extended until June of 2021. commission will continue to do all the activities that it has been doing today, but it has additional activities as well. One of the extra things that the commission will do is we'll annually make recommendations to the governor and the legislature on how savings from criminal justice reform should be reinvested to reduce recidivism. The commission also, and I think this is perhaps the most important, one of the most important pieces of the bill, the commission also will collect data, collect and analyze data collected by criminal justice agencies, including the court system and the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety, on recidivism and other factors that would enable the commission to tell the legislature what effect these changes in the law are having on criminal justice systems. So the commission will report in its annual report a summary of savings and recommendations on how savings from criminal justice reform should be reinvested to reduce recidivism. The commission will also report to you on performance metrics and outcomes from the recommendations that the commission made in its December 2015 report, which are essentially the provisions of SB 91. And that will include, for example, the percentage of inmates who return to prison 3 years after release, broken down by offense type and risk level, also the percentage of inmates who return to prison within 3 years after release, and recommendations for any additional reforms. So in the event that the provisions in if SB 91 should become law, in the event that those are either not enough or they need to be tweaked, the commission will come back based on the data it collects to the legislature with recommendations on that. The commission also is charged with cooperating with the Department of Corrections, or sorry, Department of Health and Human Services, in its efforts to increase access to evidence-based rehabilitation and reentry services. And then finally, the commission is asked or is told in this legislation to do some extra reports to you. The first one is a report on driving while intoxicated. The second one is a report on restitution. The third one is a report on social impact bonds. And the fourth one is a report on sexual offenses. So the note simply continues the staffing that the commission has had so far, which is an attorney position, and right now that position is part-time at 30 hours a week, and the note increases that to full-time at 37.5 to reflect the additional work. Also, the commission is staffed by a research analyst at 20 hours a week. The note raises that to 29 hours a week, again, because there is going to be an awful lot of data to collect and analyze. And then the last little piece of it is 7.5 hours a week of additional administrative support. We have the original note actually had no administrative support for the commission, and the Judicial Council absorbed that administrative support into its, without any funding, absorbed that support with existing staff, and we have found that that was a mistake, and we need just a little bit extra to really help the commission get organized and do its work. That's all I have, unless you've got questions.
All right, questions from committee members on fiscal note number 19. Ms. DiPietro, I don't see any questions. I want to thank you very much for walking us through fiscal note 19. Okay, the last fiscal note is from the state retirement payments. Here to speak to this fiscal note is Ms. Michelle McCod, is that right? Chief Health Officer of Retirement and Benefits from the Department of Administration. Fiscal note number 20, state retirement payments, PERS, state assistance, and all other PERS, OMB component number 2866. Ms. McCod, please place yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Michaud. I am the Chief Health Official for the Division of Retirement Benefits within the Department of Administration. And so our fiscal note speaks to sections 161 to 172 of this bill, which closes a gap in coverage and provides system-paid major medical to the survivors of peace officers and firefighters killed in the line of duty. And the cost, it does have an increase to the cost, which, as shown in our fiscal note, starts in FY17 at about $174,000 and goes up to $226,000 in FY22.
And with that, I will answer any questions that you might have.
Questions from committee on fiscal note number 20. I see none, Ms. Michaud. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
This beautiful day that it is. Okay. Seeing that there's no more questions, we will now put aside Senate Bill 91. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Saturday, April 23rd, 2016, at 11 a.m., and at that time we will bring back House Bill 379. And with that, this House Finance Committee meeting is recessed to the call of the chair.